I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Who doesn't appreciate a vibrant, exciting city? And on Smart City, we especially appreciate the people who make them. Our guests today are two such people, both from Australia. Rob Adams is Director of Design and Culture for the City of Melbourne, where he's built a remarkable track record for reanimating the city and making it sustainable. Brian Newman is Chief Executive of the Sydney Olympic Authority. It's his job to create a new precinct at the site of the 2000 Summer Olympics with its own energy and its own economic momentum. We'll talk with Rob Adams and Brian Newman today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Rob Adams is Director of Design and Culture for the City of Melbourne, Australia. A native of Zimbabwe, Rob has more than 30 years' experience as a practicing architect and urban designer. Now with the City of Melbourne, he's producing design research-based urban projects and strategies and has won more than 65 state and national awards for excellence. Last year, Rob and his in-house staff completed one of Australia's greenest buildings, Council House 2. Rob, how do you define the public realm?
Public realm for me, I suppose, is very broadly everything outside of the building. So any area that the public could access 24 hours a day would be the public realm. And the biggest component of that, and I think often the most neglected component of that, is the street. We tend to think of public realm as, you know, squares and plazas and parks and maybe the edges of waterways. But in fact, about 80% of a city's public realm are the streets. And that's the most neglected part of the public realm, in my view.
And why is it so neglected?
Well, I think a lot of our cities, particularly in America and Australia, have grown up with the idea of a suburban spread. And unfortunately, one of the byproducts of suburbia is that the street really becomes the place that we use for our cars to drive along rather than for us to actually meet our fellow citizens. And I think this very important public space has been redefined as a transport route rather than a meeting place. And this is, I think, the big challenge as we go into the 21st century, and cities have to become denser and more sustainable. The role in that is going to be very important. The role of the street in that is going to be very important.
And so what do you do with the street to make a more appealing or livable public realm?
In many instances, I think the suburban challenge is the hardest one. I think if you have already activity centres or commercial centres, they tend to be a little easier. What you need to do there is ensure that the buildings that front onto them have active frontages, that they open up to the street, that they actually support the street frontage, they don't actually set back and create or sometimes hostile spaces. Now, I think that's easy when you're sitting within the commercial sector with the retail and offices and the mixed use you get. What is going to be a larger challenge over time will be how do you take the suburban areas and make those streets more active. And it might not be necessary. It might be that if we create sufficient activity centres and that people can actually walk or cycle to an adjacent activity centre, then maybe those parts of our cities remain as transport corridors rather than social corridors. But we can improve them by widening the footpaths, planting trees, making them areas where the car isn't the total dominant factor in those streets. And, you know, people feel they can actually communicate with people they pass or neighbours, etc. None of this is new. I mean, this is what Jane Jacobs was telling us back in the 1960s, I suspect.
Well, maybe we're only now learning the lessons. Not too many years ago, Melbourne's central city was in pretty bad shape. In fact, there was a local newspaper headline in 1980 that called it an empty, useless city center. What did you find when you joined the city?
Well, what we had is, I suppose, the fairly common role being paid out by the central city, and that was it had become predominantly the central business district. It was working between 8 and 6, and people would go there to access their office accommodation, and they'd climb in their car or transport and leave. And the city was suffering under the pressures from the suburban shopping malls and people moving out of the city for their recreation and other activity. So the challenge, in fact, that we took on in the early 80s was to say, how do we actually convert the central business district into a central activities district, an area that will work 24 hours a day, will attract people back, will start to actually win back the retail, the entertainment, and in our case, in Melbourne, actually have a residential population, because we didn't have a residential population of any significance.
And, of course, now you have a fabulous central city. How did you turn the situation around?
A lot of it, I suppose, is through incremental action that we took over the last two decades. But the starting point was we had political support. It was the politicians that were driving this. Many of the politicians who came into power in the early 80s came in on the platform of needing to, in fact, regain Melbourne as Melbourne, pull out the qualities that they really thought were beneficial to the city. And they, first of all, they wrote a strategy, and that's where my involvement started. I helped write the urban design part of that strategy. And then they set up an urban design unit to implement that. And one of the significant things they did, I think, looking back, is that they wouldn't allow anything to happen. Streets couldn't be widened or slip lanes put in or any planning decision be taken without first going through that urban design subcommittee. What that did it was change the culture of the organization. Suddenly the engineers and others realized that there was an agenda, and if they didn't in fact recognize that agenda and start working with it, well, if they didn't spend their funding on roads, the funding would be taken away and given to other uses. So what that did was enlist the whole administration of the city to one particular agenda. And the agenda was this, turning the city back into a central activities district. And then there were a number of actions that came out of that. Some of them sound very simple in hindsight. We introduced a paving policy where there's only one paving stone you can use in Melbourne, which was the traditional blue stone, which is laid in 1 meter by half meter flagstones. We designed our own street furniture. We planted hundreds of trees every year since then, both in the central city and adjacent. We've required that every new building actually builds up to the street frontage and has 75% of that frontage active. So you can, you know, doors and windows, so you can actually see in to that. We've widened the footpaths. We've taken about close on 20 hectares of asphalt and other infrastructure out of the city and turn it over to the pedestrian space. And this slow process, first of all, people didn't recognize it, but about 10 years down the track, they suddenly started to say the city's greener, it seems more friendly. But the big initiative came in the early 1990s when we ran a program called Postcode 3000, where we actively encouraged residential to come back into the city. And we've gone from a residential population, this is downtown, if you take downtown and immediate inner suburbs, where there were 40,000 people back in the 1980s, and it's now getting up to 80,000 people. And there are about 12,000 apartment buildings in the central city, in the CBD, right in the core. And that has changed our city dramatically. We have a population living there, shopping, recreating. Bars, cafes, and restaurants have gone from 580 to now well over 2,000, and the city's actually come alive.
We've both seen cities that make streetscape improvement. They invest in streetscape, certainly not at the scale that you've done in Melbourne, but we've seen that, and we've seen so many of them fail. I mean, you'll see street trees, you'll see pedestrianization, you'll see a widening of sidewalks, maybe banners, those sorts of things. But the area, in the end, remains as dead as it was to begin with. What are they doing wrong, Rob? Are they not working at scale? Are they not fully committed? What's the problem?
I think you'll find most probably, and this obviously is a generalization, is that many of those schemes turn out to be beautification. There's a feeling that if you actually lay the paving and plant the trees, that that's enough. And it's not enough. Public space only works in comparison to the quality of the activities that are adjacent to it. So, and I'm an architect, despite everything we'd like to feel as architects, we can put any sort of feature into a public space. Unless the edges of that public space are active, it's most probably going to fail. And so alongside the improvements that I've talked about, the footpaths, the furniture, etc., we had a fairly active program of encouraging businesses, new businesses, to come in and open in the central city. We have a small business investment fund where we actually pay small businesses who come into our city up to $50,000 to actually get themselves established. We encouraged cafes to use the sidewalk, and whereas cities like Sydney and some of our adjacent municipalities charge $360 a meter for that space, we charge $60. And we said our priority is, this is not a revenue-raising exercise. This is about getting a quality sidewalk cafe, and we will actually concentrate on the quality. And we give them one-year leases so that you know that they don't actually push the quality, they stand to lose it. And we had a very strong arts and culture program. We invest more than any other local government in Australia in arts and culture, and we encourage performance, temporary art installations, young artists. We've got a center where primary school children go along and work with some of the top artists in the country, including visiting artists, and actually become enthused about it. And this brings the families back into the city. They, moms and dads will come back if there's stuff for the kids to do. And so it's not just about the physical beautification, it's about the activity you bring with it. And that, I think, has been Melbourne's secret, that combined those two.
You mentioned earlier the density increases that you've had in the city center. Density always produces a lot of local debate. When people hear the term density, they worry that their quality of life will be seriously compromised. You produced a chart comparing densities in cities around the world. What did you find?
Well, it's not a chart I produced. It was produced by an academic here, Peter Newman, who worked out of Murdoch University in Western Australia. And what he found was that if you take the densities of different cities throughout the world and plot them north-south margin, it would be a number of people per hectare. And what he found is the very dense cities are the Asian cities. The first European city comes in at about 200 people per hectare, and interestingly, it's Barcelona. So Barcelona is the densest city in Europe. But interestingly, Barcelona has 40% open space, big wide streets. It's only built to a height of about 6 or 7 stories. It's got a great walking environment. It's mixed use, and I think what happens with this debate on densities is people suddenly think about maybe a condominium going up next to them and some of the detrimental things that come from high rise rather than high density use. If you start to talk to people and say, well, look, what would you think about living in Barcelona? And most people who have been there would say, I'd love to live there. It's an exciting, vibrant city. And then you say, well, do you know that's actually one of the densest cities in the world? That must really be pleasantly surprised. So I think we've got to start talking about density in a slightly different way, that particularly with the sustainability problems our cities are going to face in the future, we're going to need that density to make them actually work. But it can be something that actually gives you a very high quality of life, and particularly as people age, to be involved in the city is something that I think more and more people, particularly baby boomers, are looking for. They don't want to be stuck out on an isolated block of land somewhere, removed from their community. And inner cities and densities actually provide you with a community, even if it's sitting in a coffee shop and drinking that cup of coffee and making eye contact. That is a healthy endeavor that people are seeking. So we need to take the fear out of density, because it really is not a bad thing, and many of the most successful cities in the world are, in fact, the densest cities in the world.
Do you think you take the fear out of density by pointing to cities like Barcelona and their density and yet their livability?
I think that's what we've got to do. I mean, I'm a very strong believer in height limits in cities. I know it's not a popular planning debate, and it's certainly not popular with the developers. But if I look around the world at those cities that have a very strong public realm and a vibrant public realm, and also economically quite vibrant, most of them have been cities that have actually been constrained within this height limit. So they're places like Barcelona, Paris, Prague, Copenhagen, Vienna, Berlin, to Melbourne up until the 1960s. So a lot of the vibrancy we get out of our city is in the old 40-meter height limit, which is the core of our city. Whereas we battle a little in the areas where the heights have been taken off and high rises dominated. We get greater winds in those areas, less sun in the street, and it's a harder piece of city to work with. So I think we've got to refer to those examples. We've also got to refer to some of the mechanisms that allow those examples to come about, and height limits is one of them. And I think, interestingly, the thing that will bring this debate on will be the whole issue of sustainability of our city. We're waking up belatedly to the fact that mostly the best energy of all is solar energy. And if you then start to say, well, you need some equity about who gains access to solar energy, the most equitable way of doing that is saying, well, everybody builds to the same height, so we've all got equal democratic access to solar energy. And people might say, well, that'd be a boring city. Well, go and have a look at Barcelona, Paris, Prague, all the rest of them. I think that's where the debate is going, and it's exciting.
I want to talk with you about the value of design. Melbourne's public realm has an obvious emphasis on good design. How did you convince city officials that design was worth it?
I think two things. I think without trying to talk down the city I love, Melbourne's pretty boring in its topography. We sit in the floodplain and a fairly nondescript river or two rivers run through it. And so if you wanted to actually create some feeling of amenity in that city, the only way it was ever going to come was through design. So from the earliest times, and Melbourne was lucky, it grew up in the mid-19th century on the back of a gold rush in the adjacent small towns of Ballarat and Bendigo. And so it had a very strong Victorian architecture, very high-quality buildings, good streets. And it started to realize the value of having this quality design within it. My convincing the city they needed to carry on actually didn't have to do that, because the politicians who came in the early 80s were architects and people out of design and culture and those backgrounds, and they knew the quality, attributes of good design and their benefits for cities. So, in fact, the platform set up in the early 80s was reintroducing design to cities. And I think what a lot of cities had done, and increasingly did through the 90s, was contract out their design skills. You saw the loss of the city architect or the government architect. These were services that you could just go and buy off the peg, and a lot of cities saw that as being an efficient way of doing it. Unfortunately, you need a memory in a city. You need someone or a group of people who know what the particular city, what its characteristics are, and how you can build on those and improve them. And what Melbourne did is said, no, we're going to reestablish the position of effectively the government architect, although they've never called it that. And we will put design right at the forefront. And the small group of people that I work with, 20 years later, we now are up to sort of 90 design awards. And that's not just awards for awards' sake, but the philosophy is, if we can attract the best people to come and work with us, the best designers, and they want to work with us because we're doing quality work, then when we have to provide advice to the city in terms of development control, the public realm, etc., they're getting professional advice, and they're getting advice that is based on an understanding of where this city's going, not where some other city might be going. And so that's been the argument, and fortunately we've managed to actually retain it for the last sort of 24 years, and the city is starting to be recognized for having this design quality, and hopefully we'll be able to hang on to it.
Is there anything that you require in terms of design for for-profit developers? Do their projects go through any sort of design review?
You know, this is quite an interesting issue because I'm often asked, and actually I sit on the City of Sydney's design review panel.
Do you?
I do, yes. But my personal view is if you have a strong in-house design team, you don't need a design review panel that comes from the outside. What we've done over the last 20 years in Melbourne is we've actually said to the development fraternity, and it didn't work all at once, they finally became convinced, is if you come and talk to us early on, the things that we require you to do are actually not that difficult. We might be saying to you, look, we want you to build up street frontage, we want active frontages, we want you to ameliorate any wind effects from your buildings, you know, we want you to put the car parking entrances not on the main street and keep them as narrow as possible so they don't disrupt the street frontage. We will give you that up front. You know, we will look at the site with you and we will give you that in a very small, concise document, and we'll carry on assisting you in this way through your you know, design development and development application. And if you do that, the likelihood is that your approval is going to be a lot faster than you, you know, behind closed doors, designing something and then coming to trying to beat it through the system. And I don't believe in us commenting on the quality of architecture. I think there are plenty of good architects, and our role is to comment on the quality of those aspects that actually make streets work or make public spaces work. And then the architecture obviously is a bonus. And so we haven't had a design review panel since 1985. They had one when I came there, and it was one of the first things I got rid of, because the trouble with the design review panel is, again, the people who come onto that panel come from their own background and environment, and design is a subjective thing. And so they might bring a particular approach to design that doesn't suit Melbourne or downtown Melbourne. And therefore, I'm not a great supporter of those. I think you've got to get a dialogue with developers and the city and a clear understanding of what the city is trying to do to improve it. And what we find is the developers start to appreciate that. They come on board. We've actually done some pilot sites where we bought a whole city block and packaged it up and put it out to the market and said we didn't want it to be designed by one architect. Each building had to be designed by a new up-and-coming architect. And now developers are using that same mechanism and coming back to us and saying, look, we've got this large scheme and we've actually put it out to a competition and we've said there couldn't be one architect for the whole scheme, etc. So it is a dialogue, I think, between the city and developers. It shouldn't be confrontational.
Rob, thanks so much for being on Smart City with us.
Look, it was great pleasure.
Rob Adams is Director of Design and Culture for the City of Melbourne. After a short break, we'll find out how Sydney's Olympic Park is slowly evolving into a new work, play, live, learn district for Sydney. But first, Planetta's and assistant editor Nate Berg has the latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development.
In an effort to sway a vote in the U.S. House of Representatives against a Democrat-sponsored energy conservation bill, a Republican congressman from North Carolina ridiculed a proposal to encourage bicycle use as a, quote, 19th century solution. According to Streets blog, Congressman Patrick McHenry of the 10th District of North Carolina is quoted in the Congressional Record admonishing the House Democrats before last week's vote. McHenry sharply criticized their plan to create a federal tax break of $20 per month for bike commuters, claiming that the idea of telling the American people that riding bikes is the solution to our current energy crisis is ridiculous. But despite McHenry's vocal opposition, the Democrats' bill passed. Aside from the tax break for commuting cyclists, the bill also includes provisions to improve the efficiency of another 19th century invention, the automobile. And while the politicians in Washington continue to fight across the aisle, residents in Oregon are battling over another divide. Homeowners and hunters have been squabbling lately in Portland over the city's urban growth boundary. The Oregonian reports that homeowners are upset over the upcoming four-month duck hunting season that subjects them and their families to the frequent sounds of shotgun blasts. The hunters argue that they are hunting on the other side of the urban growth boundary and are therefore in the right. Furthermore, they say if the homeowners didn't want to be so close to the rural lifestyle on the other side of the boundary, they shouldn't have moved to the edge. This clash of lifestyles is sure to continue, but the debate highlights the larger issue in Portland, of accommodating the area's rapid growth while protecting the region's remaining rural spaces. And finally, in yet another dispute, residents in Toronto are fuming over what they see as discriminatory urban design. The Toronto Star reports that many of the sidewalks in the city are sloped, serving as ramps for cars to get off the street and up into the driveway. And though this does make the ride easier for cars, it makes walking a little difficult. A citizens group has elicited the support of a local city councilman to address the auto-oriented offense, which they argue is potentially dangerous to the elderly and the disabled. And as the city gets ready to develop its pedestrian policy later this year, they hope that the city's unwalkable sidewalks will finally be corrected. After all, they say, if they weren't meant to be walked on, they wouldn't be called sidewalks. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of Planetizen. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Brian Newman is chief executive of the Sydney Olympic Park Authority, site of the 2000 Summer Olympics. Although the 2 weeks of games are the focus of the world's attention, it's what comes after that ultimately becomes the difference between success and failure. And that responsibility in Sydney falls to Brian Newman. Brian, the Olympics were held in Sydney 7 years ago now. What was the Olympic legacy for Sydney?
Well, I think there are many aspects of the Olympic legacy. I think the most obvious one would be the legacy of what I'd call hard infrastructure. Not only the new transport systems, but of course the array of world-class sporting venues. It had been nearly 100 years since New South Wales, the state of New South Wales, had seen a major investment in new sporting infrastructure, so that was long overdue. Of course, we've also seen a legacy of benefits to the Sydney brand as a global city, heightened recognition of Sydney in a global marketplace, increasing tourism off the back of that, tremendous business benefits. I think Sydney, more than a lot of other Olympic cities, have been able to leverage the expertise that was gained from the Sydney Olympic Games in an international context. And of course, the thing that I'm most interested in, which is the creation of a post-Olympic legacy within the Olympic Park itself.
I want to come back and talk to you about that, but first let me ask you, you said that you were able to leverage the Olympics expertise in a global market. Tell me about that.
Yes, I think because the Sydney Games were so successful, it certainly enhanced our international reputation as a city that could deliver. Mm-hmm. And there have been a lot of people associated with that successful project that have been sort of quite sought after in the international marketplace and have been sort of advising the cities of London and Beijing and other bid cities like Paris for the 2012 Games. I understand that for the Qatar Asian Games, there were something like 600 Australians involved in assisting with the delivery of that major event in the Asia-Pacific area. So some examples of just how that has been leveraged.
So it's become, in effect, a consulting industry.
A consulting industry, but also benefits to suppliers, for example, and both of goods and services. I know of one company that supplies seats for stadiums that has grown its international market, and also waste cleaning services. The Australian company that provided that service for the Sydney Olympic Games went on to provide those services in Atlanta.
Oh, how interesting. Sydney was the first Olympics that I recall having a strong focus on being green. But it doesn't seem, Brian, that the city has quite capitalized on that opportunity. What's your opinion on that?
I think that's a fair comment at a city level. Certainly at the Olympic precinct itself, we've sought to actually build on that agenda, and we're doing that in many ways. But I think as a city, it's very hard to, I guess, position oneself as a green city in a global sort of sense. And I'm not sure that that agenda, at a strategic sense, has really been captured.
Mm-hmm. But how are you building on it in the Olympic precinct?
Well, I guess the environmental sustainability agenda is part of a broader sustainability agenda, but we have sought to, I guess, become an exemplar for sustainable urban development. And so all new development within this precinct will be developed to the highest international standards for sustainable building design. All buildings will be supplied with recycled water. In fact, within this total precinct of around 1,500 acres, only about 3% of all of the water we use is potable water. The rest is recycled water from sewage and stormwater that we gather here. We've also reduced the percentage of waste which is taken to landfill to around 30%, and we continue to work on reducing that. And our commitment to the use of sustainable materials, to the use of green energy, continues. In fact, we're now looking at introduction of more cogeneration systems for power supply. So, yeah, we're very, very committed to not only sustaining that reputation as a green site, but becoming an international sort of exemplar for it.
Tell me how the Olympic Park in Sydney is used today.
Today, we I guess our vision for Sydney Olympic Park is for it to become a vibrant, unique urban centre within metropolitan Sydney, one characterised by a very strong sense of place built on that Olympic heritage, but also representing an example for sustainable urban development. So in keeping with that vision, we're promoting a major program of urban development, over $1 billion of new private sector investment in new hotels and residential development, commercial development has now been committed. But we've also seen a wonderful sort of growth in the level of visitation, use and enjoyment of the Olympic precinct. We've seen visitation grow from around 4 million just after the Olympics to now just over 8 million, and we're targeting 10 million by 2010.
And what's bringing people to the site, Brian?
Many things. Of course, events continue to be a major attraction. I mean, Sydney Olympic Park is a place of celebration, of festivity, and there are so many positive memories that are part of that legacy, in fact. But also, we're growing education programs. Over 100,000 school students now visit the park on curriculum-based education programs. Over a million people use the Aquatic Centre. It's been a fantastic leisure resource. Nearly 1.6 million people use the parklands. Again, a wonderful, wonderful legacy of the Sydney Olympic Games. So business events, education, leisure activities, tourism make up that visitation mix.
And will the parklands remain as you develop the site?
Certainly, they certainly will. They're very, very well protected. And these are unique parklands. There'd be few cities in the world where in its very heart, at the demographic and the geographic heart of the city, you will find nearly 1,000 acres of parklands comprising wetlands and woodlands, recreational spaces, heritage precincts, and of course it all sits on the beautiful Sydney Harbour. So, and it's very, very located very close to our new town centre within this new township that we're developing. And so Sydney Olympic Park is becoming a hub for leisure, lifestyle-based activities, and in that sense has a much broader regional role to play for the people of Sydney. The park has been, the catalyst for a major program of urban development in this central part of Sydney, and I think one of the main attractions for people deciding to live and to work in this area is the ability to balance one's life by accessing all of these wonderful leisure activities. We have nearly 50 sports played in the precinct, so whether you want to be active or whether you want to be engaged in passive activities within the parklands, there's that wonderful array of options for you.
Tell me the location of the Olympic precinct relative to the central city of Sydney.
As I mentioned, it is located in the centre of Sydney, so that places it about 15 kilometres from the central business district.
Mm-hmm.
Sydney is skewed very much to the coast, that is to the east of New South Wales. And so we're located in the middle. We're about also equidistant to our second largest city. Sydney is described as a city of cities, and there are six cities comprising the city of Sydney, but of course the hub is the central business district right on Sydney Harbour that most people are kind of very familiar with.
It's 7 years after the Olympics. How long did it take for the post-Olympic vision for this precinct to come into view, in to become clear?
It's an interesting sort of question, one that I'm asked very often, particularly by bid cities and host cities of Olympic mm-hmm. Games. I think it would be true to say that our approach was to create a platform, quite a flexible platform at the pre-Olympic stage for future development to occur. There was no clear vision of the urban form or the functions of this place at the pre-Olympic stage. And it was just after the Olympics that the first master plan was approved for Sydney Olympic Park. And I joined this organisation around about the time that first master plan was approved. I think it was very clear even then that it was quite a narrow idea about the potential of this wonderful place. And so a couple of years after that, we proceeded to develop a new vision. And we're very close now to gaining approval for a vision of a new town that will accommodate nearly 20,000 residents, about 20,000 workers, 6,000 to 7,000 students in a new education campus, and of course thousands of visitors to the precinct. And we have to generate a critical mass of people living and working and learning here to create that sort of day-to-day vibrancy. So we're going from a place which I guess could be described as one that offered the extraordinary, particularly through events, to a place that whose sustainability is built on the ordinary day-to-day activities, but then overlaid by all these festivals and wonderful events that we also hold here. So a very unique place and a very challenging placemaking exercise to balance the needs of the precinct as a major events venue, and of course that there's a very important economic contribution that makes to Sydney and the state of New South Wales, but to balance that against the need to provide amenity to the residents and the workers and the students who enjoy it on a day-to-day basis. But I think we've found the right balance now.
A couple of things you've said I want to follow up on. What was it about the Olympics as originally conceived in Sydney and Olympics Precinct specifically that made it a flexible platform?
I think it probably really started with the urban structure. We have, as the urban designers like to say, very good bones. We have a very traditional cross-axis. Olympic Boulevard is the main north-south axis, and it's crossed by another boulevard called Dawn Fraser Avenue. And I think the broad urban structure was a block structure, gave us a good starting point to build a more traditional urban structure, but introducing a finer grain. I think one of the challenges of Olympic precincts is that I guess the characteristics are that they're occupied by monumental buildings. They very, very large public spaces. We have to accommodate somewhere around 250,000 people in public spaces. There's a sense of grandness and stiffness that goes with that. And the next layer of our work is to introduce a finer grain of urban structure, new streets, new pocket parks, public places that make it a lot more comfortable for people that are living and working here, because the actually scale of the place, the issue of distance, the travelling distances and so forth, is one which is characteristic of an Olympic precinct, but one that needs to be dealt with in another way in the post-Olympic phase.
And do you think those distances and that scale, again, as you put it, at a very grand level, is necessary for an Olympics site? In other words, is that necessary to handle the event and to be what the event needs to be, and then, as you say, then obviously needs to be changed if people are going to live and work there on a daily basis?
Carol, it does depend upon how many Olympic venues one decides to actually locate within the Olympic precinct. You can have too many in terms of the post-Olympic agenda for urban development. We have 10 venues within the precinct, everything from the Olympic Stadium to major entertainment venues, athletics facilities, hockey fields, a major tennis complex. And if you have too many, it can certainly make the post-Olympic process of urban development and trying to find that finer grain a lot more difficult. But the Olympics, it's such a huge event, so many people involved, and when you address the operational issues of how you move people into the precinct, how you gather people, prepare them to go into venues, you find yourself, and also the fact that you need long distances from, for example, the train station to major venues. You can't have venues located too close, otherwise you'll get tremendous stacking in between the venue and the train station, so you have to have distance in order for people to dissipate themselves into the precinct. And when you have a look at the operational requirements of an Olympic event and match those against your ideal situation in a post-Olympic sort of sense, then there can be some conflict. But that's part of, I guess, part of the challenge that we've faced in an urban design sense.
I think, Brian, you're using the fact that Olympic Park was used for major sporting events as inspiration for some economic development initiatives there. How do you see the park's economic future developing?
As part of our sustainability agenda, it was critical that we identified an economic agenda to ensure the ongoing sustainability of the precinct. Events, in my mind, are somewhat almost the icing on the cake. They're a little superficial in sort of some ways. What we wanted to create was an Olympic precinct, a new town that had an economy which was built on the precinct's heritage as an Olympic precinct and as a place that enjoyed all these wonderful venues, but in a more driven by a more sustainable idea. So when we looked at where our competitive advantage was, we identified six areas. One was, of course, the area of sport, or the industry of sport. Another was the health, leisure, and well-being industry. Then there was education, environment, events, and culture, the arts and entertainment. And the one that stood out, of course, was sport. And when we looked at the industry of sport, we identified 13 dimensions. And so we've created an economic development strategy for sport based on 13 industry segments, which include things like sports retail, sports education, sports science, sports medicine, sports culture, sports administration. And for each one of those 13 industry segments, we are taking a very proactive approach in trying to attract organizations to relocate to Sydney Olympic Park. And as each piece of that jigsaw puzzle is put into place, it just becomes a more attractive place for other organizations. And what we hope to do is create a really unique model, an internationally unique model for the sports industry here. Not just, well, of course, we'll have our events and we'll have tremendous participation by the public in the use of venues, but it's a deeper, broader idea about sport, and I think one which will make it internationally unique.
Yeah, I love this idea. Is that in part where the learning comes in, Brian? Are you trying to bring learning into the precinct that is particularly related to the sports industry?
We are, and in fact, I mentioned that education was another of the six key economic themes. When we looked at Sydney Olympic Park and what it offered, it just stood out as a potential education campus. The scale and form of buildings that we wish to promote here suited a campus-style environment. We have excellent public transport, wonderful recreational facilities for students to enjoy. We'll have the cafes and so forth as the development rolls out. So we, and given our central location in Sydney and the enormous growth, particularly in the provision of private sector education programs at all levels, we thought this was an opportunity for us. And so within the master plan, we've set aside a large area of land, in fact, land around some of our sporting venues, the athletics competition arena, the warm-up track, and our aquatic center, for an education campus specializing in sport.
Mm-hmm.
And we have organizations in the precinct now like the Australian College of Physical Education, which has about 1,000 students and specializing in sports education programs and dance. We're a one-third shareholder in a company called Sports Knowledge Australia, and its agenda is to export Australian expertise in sports management and sports science, and that's a joint venture with two of Sydney's leading universities. We're also promoting active lifestyle programs for young people so that they can visit the precinct, which of course is a very exciting thing for them to come to the Olympic site, but engage in any type of recreational activity. It could be riding a bicycle or throwing a frisbee or kicking a ball, but it's all curriculum-based, which means it's actually linked to programs around, it could be personal health and physical education, it could be science, so they'll learn the physics of riding a bicycle and gears and so forth. So it's fun, but it's also part of a learning process. And we're talking to a private school at the moment that's looking to establish a school from everything from kindergarten right through to senior high, specializing in sport and environmental studies. And finally, a new initiative, which is to create a college for sport and health studies. In Sydney, we have a number of high schools that specialize in sport, and this would become almost a center of excellence for those students. There would be students that would be resident here at the park, but it would also be a place where developing sports athletes can visit and access the coaches, the administrators, organizations like the New South Wales Institute for Sport, all the infrastructure that we have here, and gain really world-class opportunities to develop their learning and, of course, their particular talents in whatever sport that may be. So, and that's just a start. That's been achieved in the last 2 to 3 years, and this is a 20-year development program. So we're very excited about the potential of filling that education campus with similar organizations.
If you could give a word of advice to cities considering hosting a one-time major event, maybe an Olympics, maybe it's a capital of culture, could be something else, what would you tell them?
It's just Olympics offer just such wonderful opportunities, and certainly the need to think beyond just the event itself and how you can leverage the major investment. I mean, typically we're talking billions of dollars worth of investment in preparing a city for an Olympic Games. So one has to ensure that you get long-term returns from that investment, and that's the legacy agenda. And those returns, are so diverse and can include social returns such as improved health of a city, of a country as a result of increased awareness of the benefits of sport and physical activity. But there are global cities lining up to host the future Olympic Games, and so whilst some commentators continue to be critical of the Olympics, it's interesting that global cities continue to see them as a very important event to enhance their positioning and the infrastructure within their city.
Brian, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
It's been my pleasure.
Brian Newman is Chief Executive of the Sydney Olympic Park Authority. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Do you look to the internet to keep up to date on what's happening in your city? CityViews commentator Walker Smith says, there's another way.
All my life, I've been a porch sitter. A big, comfortable porch tops my list of what a house has to have. The back porch of the house I live in today overlooks an overgrown wooded gully that buffers our house from the clamor of the city in which we live. It's a serene place to sit, with a view of 100-foot trees, flowering vines, scurrying wildlife, scores of birds, and even the occasional hawk. On cool, misty fall mornings, my back porch feels like a secret mountain hideaway. In contrast, the front porch of my house is not hidden away at all. It's wide open to the street. Sitting there on the porch swing, I feel connected to all the neighborhood goings-on. Neighbors come up to talk. The mail carrier waves, children scamper by. Strolling couples nod hello as their dogs trot over for a pat on the head. up and down the block, life spills out, and on my front porch, I feel caught up in it. More and more, my front porch is where I sit. I used to crave the solitude in the back, but over time I've come to understand that what I need most is the community out front. It buoys me up as it sweeps me along in its current. It's enlivening and animating, and as friendly and as nourishing as I'm willing to make it. I still need my back porch as an occasional getaway, but on my front porch I feel so invigorated by life that I don't want to let any of it get away from me. Sitting on my front porch, I think back sometimes to childhood visits to my grandparents' house in rural Alabama. Many a summer afternoon, my grandmother and I would sit on the deep wooden porch that fronted the entire length of her country house. We would watch the road and wave at everyone walking or driving by. Usually, though, traffic was slow, so mostly she and I just talked and visited. Late in the day, as the hot afternoon would cool into early evening, she would get up from her rocker and stand at the edge of her front porch and yell at the top of her voice to a friend who lived within shouting distance away. For the next few minutes, my grandmother and her friend would holler snippets of news and gossip back and forth. Standing there on her front porch, my grandmother could close the circle on her day by connecting with the community around her. I suppose that's why I've always been a porch sitter. I remember from way back how decent a good porch can make you feel, particularly a good front porch that opens out into the surrounding community. City life isn't always easy. Many of us know the worst of it from personal experience. But we also know that notwithstanding all the worries, hassles, and nuisances, our neighborhoods offer us something that is hospitable and redeeming. In the midst of it all, when it comes to our neighborhoods, we need and crave the view from our front porches. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich and author of the forthcoming book, Generation Ageless, in bookstores October 2nd. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders who just released the new report, Kids in Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.